David, your jokes, with all due respect, are never very good, but that's what makes them good.
Thanks, buddy. Thank you.
That's what's good about them.
So a meeting at the Oval Office went about as well as that time that your cousin, who's like that, you know, failed to launch cousin that just sits in his basement and plays video games all day. Well, that time that he went to you and asked for a loan, and then you said, hey, I'd rather you get a job first. And then he threw a tantrum and it was like this big blow up in the family. That's pretty much Trump and Zelensky. That's the same vibe.
Yeah, that checks out.
That's about right.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction. We are glad to have you here. We have a very special show. Before we get into that, I'll have David cue it up for us. We'd like for you to smash that like button, subscribe, hit the notification bell on YouTube so you don't miss a notification of a new show from us. David, why don't you set us up here?
Well, we got you and me and no Ben and a Kyle, but we do have the great Scott Horton here. He's the author of Provoked, How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. He's also the OG, not the OG, but an OG of antiwar.com, host of the Scott Horton Show, Antiwar Radio, who have pretty much provided me my education on foreign policy when I given up on it in my mid-20s. He brought me back. And editorial director of the Libertarian Institute. Scott, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you both so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so we're going to be diving into that that White House meeting. So it's so crazy. It's gone so viral. It's hard to, everyone's seen it. But what I wanted to do is like, man, we got Scott Horton on. What do I do? What would be the coolest thing I could think of? Well, what if we just put Scott in the room and we just like dived into the whole drama of it and let him respond to all this shenanigans that happened?
Can I just say that would be the most amazing thing? Like to have you in the room with Trump and Zelensky would just be so juicy. So yeah, I'm excited to get into this.
So the explosive exchange has gone mega viral. We have the media with kind of engaging a lot of this rhetoric around it. It's got a bit of a political Rorschach test, right? So everyone, it's, you know, you see the car crash, you see the like the little ink blot, and everyone gets something different out of it. We want to dig to the truth. We want to see what actually is the history of Russia and Ukraine and what should be informing these decisions. To kind of cue it up, so at the very some stuff happened the week prior that kind of went a little less noticed, which was Rubio, Secretary of State Rubio, who's doing surprisingly better than I would have thought he would have done with this whole thing, talking about Zelensky kind of double dealing in his relationships to them, to his relationships to the media.
I think the second thing is, frankly, I was personally very upset because we had a conversation with President Zelensky, the vice president and I, the two, three of us. And we discussed this issue about the mineral rights. And we explained to them, look, we want to be in a joint venture with you, not because we're trying to steal from your country, but because we think that's actually a security guarantee. If we're your partner in an important economic endeavor, we get to get paid back some of the money the taxpayers have given, close to $200 billion. And it also, now we have a vested interest in the security of Ukraine. And he said, sure, we want to do this deal. It makes all the sense in the world. The only thing is I need to run it through my legislative process. They have to approve it. I read 2 days later that Zelensky's out there saying, I rejected the deal. I told him no way that we're not doing that. Well, that's not what happened in that meeting. So you start to get upset by somebody. We're trying to help these guys. One of the points the president made in his messaging is not that we don't care about Ukraine, but Ukraine is on another continent. You know, it doesn't directly impact the daily lives of Americans. We care about it because it has implications for our allies and ultimately for the world. There should be some level of gratitude here about this. And when you don't see it and you see him out there accusing the president of living in a world of disinformation, that's highly, very counterproductive. And I don't need to explain to you or anybody else, President Trump's not the kind of person that's going to sit there and take that. He's very transparent.
Yeah. So I think it's great that, and I want to hear your reaction on this, Scott, the evolution of Mark Rubio from Arch Warhawk to the John Mearsheimer School of Realism all of a sudden.
Well, he's doing a job. The job is to do what the president says, not what you want. And so, you know, the first time around, Trump was just surrounded by enemies and it was his own fault. You know, he was too lazy to know who were good people to surround himself with. So he surrounded himself with James Mattis and Rex Tillerson and H.R. McMaster and all these people whose job it was to prevent him from doing his job and prevent him from taking control of the executive branch. So this time, you know, Rubio as you were kind of implying there, or you said outright, I guess, has been just a horrible hawk his entire career. But he clearly auditioned for this role under the guise of, yes, Mr. President, I'll be your guy, and not I'll be here to stop you from being you, right? That had to have been the agreement in the first place, because you can tell the way he's adapted. Now, I don't know, but I suspect, and I would be surprised to find otherwise, that when Trump asks him his advice, I'm sure he gives him all bad advice. He is a hawk. He agrees with the hawks on everything that he's ever thought about before, you know? He's always sided with them on essentially everything. He's had a purely John McCainian foreign policy, including, you know, going with McCain and Hillary to Libya in 2011 and all these things that just you would think would be impossible to live down. But, you know, not to go on too far of a tangent, but Trump somehow convinced Zalmay Khalilzad, who was a card-carrying neoconservative who had studied under Leo Strauss at the University of Chicago with Bill Kristol and all those guys, to agree to make a deal with the Taliban to get the hell out of there, to end that war. They went around Kabul. They didn't invite Kabul along. It was just a bilateral deal between America and the Taliban. And he presumably could have sabotaged it. He could have prevented it, you know, kind of slow walked it and waited for Trump to get unelected in 2020. And let it fall apart. And I think maybe enough of the foreign policy establishment was ready to call it quits in Afghanistan at that time. But my impression at the time was, and I don't know if I had any like real evidence for this or solid reporting about this, but it just seemed like they must have had a very serious conversation about, listen, if I give you this job, you have to promise me you work just for me and you're going to do this job. I'm the president and you're my guy. And Khalilzad agreed to that. So I bring that up because it seems like Trump must have learned that lesson. That if he's upfront with people about this, especially like for a Secretary of State, it's one thing, but like also this guy Witkoff that he's hired to go and do negotiations with Russia and with Israel. Witkoff doesn't work for Rubio and the State Department. He works directly for the president, and that means he's got juice. He could speak for the president and he could do a lot of things. But you know, the flip side of that is that he doesn't get to make his own decisions at all. He's there to do the president's will. So I wouldn't give Rubio credit here for really being anything other than ambitious and being as loyal as his ambition requires him to be. He can never be the president of the United States anyway, so his ambition doesn't matter. This is as high as he's ever going to get as Thomas Jefferson's chair. Well, now Jefferson made it to the presidency, but Rubio ain't ever getting higher than Secretary of State.
God, I hope not. Scott, I'm curious. So the framework of this deal that they came to sign at this press conference, or at least to talk about, is all around giving the U.S. rights to Ukrainian rare earth minerals. And there was also some mention of establishing LNG exports to Europe. But the mandate that Trump had in the election was to end the Russia-Ukraine war. And so I think a question that a lot of folks are asking is, how do the rare earth minerals incorporate into the peace deal that everyone is sort of expecting Trump to be working on right now?
Right. Okay, so my take is that if Trump had his way with everybody right now, he would sign a peace deal with Putin to end the war, and Ukraine would agree to end the fighting on their side and accept the line somewhere negotiable, but they would solve that. And then, as he explained it, as somehow payback, as Rubio was saying there, somehow payback for the $200 billion that Biden already gave them, they would enter into these mineral deals. But most importantly, as Rubio explained there, and as Trump also said in the big press conference that devolved into the shouting match, as Trump said at the beginning, echoing the same thing as Rubio here, that this is sort of a half-assed war guarantee in a sense. This is like our troops in Korea, our tripwire for war. Only now we're talking about miners. They don't even have the capacity to defend themselves at all. They'll be civilian laborers who the Russians wouldn't dare accidentally kill them in a fight if they invaded again, would be the thing that we would dare them to not do that, which is a bluff that works until it fails. To repeat myself from the other day, but if it fails, then that means at least potentially that we would go to war with Russia to guarantee Ukraine's new border. Well, We weren't willing to go to war with Russia to guarantee their old border. Why are we willing to do this? And the whole absurdity of the war is, you know, based on America refusing to sign a deal promising not to bring Ukraine into NATO, even though they didn't want to bring Ukraine into NATO, and they proved they weren't willing to fight for Ukraine. So paper treaty or not, comes down to it, we're not going, because that would mean war with Russia, and we're not willing to have war with Russia. And the paper is not what makes the difference. And that ought to raise real questions. Donald Trump or anybody else in that chair, that ought to raise questions in the minds of the Eastern Europeans. Are the Americans really coming for you if you get into a fight with Russia? Are the people of Austin, Texas really willing to trade our hometown for yours? Because no, we're not. And to keep, you know, Western Europe out of the hands of the Soviet Union back then, maybe. But to keep Eastern Europe out of the hands of Russia now, there's no way. I mean, I guess I could see, you know, even this president or a future one trying to field a conventional army in the Baltic states, possibly to live up to the NATO promise and thwart an invasion by Russia if it came down to it. And America could probably defeat them, although I don't know exactly know what it would look like. But, you know, presumably they have the amount of air power to bear, to bring to bear. But as we all know, that would be risking an H-bomb war.
Right.
This would be a fight, you know, 6,000-7,000 miles from our shores, where we're risking every major city in America in a fight in what is an existential threat for somebody else who ain't us. And this goes to the heart of one of the hearts of this whole stupid policy this whole time in expanding the NATO alliance. You listen to the Americans and the Europeans talk about this, they're essentially, they convince themselves that all they're doing is spreading stability, but they're spreading instability ultimately, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of erasing dividing lines, they've redrawn the dividing line in a way to directly pick a fight with Russia. Mm-hmm. But if you hear them talk about it, everybody wants to be a member of NATO, but that means, of course, that members of NATO don't fight among each other. And so all we're doing is we're spreading our security umbrella. In fact, at one point, I think it was Bush Sr. himself even brought this up, although, God, I wonder if he must have been being sarcastic or what. But like, but the question comes up, and it's, to me, the argument ad absurdum. The answer is obviously no, but maybe we just give a war guarantee to every nation on Earth. The UN treaty says that all the nations promise not to invade each other. Well, here, America says if any nation invades any other nation, we will always come to the aggrieved's defense as judged by us. Now, that's obviously biting off far more than we can chew. And it means, you know, when we talk about geopolitics, that's not just the politics of the globe. It means of the shape of the land as it lays on the surface of the planet, right? There are cliffs and mountains and deserts and vast areas of Eurasia that are nowhere near oceans or seas for us to approach, and all of these kinds of things that absolutely prevent that from being reasonable to do. Now, I like to think that if America was a limited constitutional republic and didn't have a world empire at all, that we could host peace conferences all day and try to help these other nations to solve their own problems. But, you know, this is the problem of all collective security and the doctrine of the real new order since World War II is this collective security that says if anybody's under attack, then to some degree or another, we all are, whether it's an Article 5 declaration or not, it's illegal. And so the international community must solve it. But that means us. And that means a lot of the times expanding a war that otherwise would have been a small one, would have either come to a negotiated end or one side would defeat the other and that would be it. So now we're obligated far beyond what we're capable of defending. And you know what's funny is that we talk about all of this when we all know that our every year in the budget, the interest payments on the debt is more than the cost of the entire military. And the entire military is really $1.7 trillion. It's much more than a trillion when you add it all up. Winslow Wheeler did the math on that recently. And yet the interest payment is more than that. It's $2 trillion. Imagine that. $2 trillion. is just going to pay the interest on the debt. And we're talking about how exactly to manage our world empire. I'm sorry, but that's just completely crazy, right? Yeah. You're absolutely out of seed corn. You're eating borrowed seed corn now, right? This is absolutely nuts for us to even be contemplating that we can do this. And people who have nothing to lose whatsoever are the ones saying that we have to continue to do this forever.
You know, at least one of my theories on this is they're saying, okay, we're going to be realists now. So we need to create an interest. Now, we would define interest as like America, where we live. But they're like, well, interest means whatever we can tangibly say is a loss, right? So they're going to create this interest in Ukraine so they can justify further Ukraine intervention and say, and that's how Trump can walk away with, well, I cut a deal and now it's in our interest, right? Yep. So he can now play himself that way. Second to that, I kind of see this as a payoff to, and this, I call this the Mike Benz theory of Ukraine and what how we wound up here, which is that the IRI and NED wanted liquid natural gas so that they could, you know, sell that to Europe and use that for finance for London and New York to finance that whole thing. That's why Hunter Biden was on the, you know, board of Burisma. That's why they do the Maidan coup. And ultimately, this all boils down to natural gas. And it's really interesting because Trump doesn't mention natural gas. And when he does, he frames it as, well, we don't need to import that to America. We got plenty here. Right. So he did emphasize that. But Zelensky keeps bringing it up through the part of the interview that no one ever have seen. And no one really watches because it isn't explosive. It's when they're all, you know, buddy buddy and everyone's cool with each other at the very beginning. But then he just drops this, well, LNG, we're going to build LNG extraction pipeline. What do you think of that theory? Is that correct? Is that the right way to think about it? Or is it too black hat really to say for certain?
Well, look, I mean, I don't think it's just a correlation that Victoria Nuland, when she gave her big speech at the Ukrainian America Foundation in December of 2013, is standing with a giant chevron banner behind her.
That's right. Yes.
They had real interest there in trying to develop. It's, you know, a little bit of natural gas and some shale oil there, but you know, it's not that much really. And you know, it's maybe it's a lot to Chevron as long as they can get us to pick up the tab. But like overall, in terms of affecting American GDP for the better, whatever, it's a total loss, it's a total, you know, beyond a wash.
But it serves a strategic interest, right? Because then you don't need Russian LNG, and you can isolate the gas station with an army.
Yeah, because
out of Europe.
But they just don't have enough to do that. I mean, it is. See, the problem was that the Americans were upset that Germany was moving closer to Russia, and Merkel had closed down all the nuclear plants and made them more dependent on Russian natural gas through the Nord Stream pipelines. And then, but that meant the more that they used Nord Stream, the more they could just cut out Ukraine, which Ukraine, you know, takes royalties on the transfer fees for piping Russian gas through Ukraine to Russia, which is the direction all that gas had to go before. So here they're cutting the Ukrainians out and I guess making them poorer and more of a welfare case for the West. So that was something that the Americans wanted to prevent there, keep the Ukrainians getting paid from the Russian side and prevent Germany and Russia from getting too close. This was the Eurasian home arrangement that Merkel was seeking with Putin there. So now As far as Hunter getting the job at Burisma, you know, just for this, I'd like to talk more about that with Benz. He talks really fast sometimes. I try to keep up, but it's true that there is a big dispute between Burisma and what was called Ukrnafta, which was another gas company there in the east. And I'd have to go back. I have a bit on this in my book. I'm pretty sure that Yulia Tymoshenko, the so-called gas princess, the lady with always the Princess Leia braids, she was, I'm pretty sure, at Ukrnafta and had been, and then that one was the one that was closer to Russia and that she was prosecuted for treason for making a deal with Putin in after, would have been 08 or 09 or something. Anyway, I'm sorry. I got to go back. All that's in the book with footnotes and coherent instead of what I just said. But I think the real reason that Hunter Biden was given the job was that Zelensky, who was the owner of Burisma, and they say that there are some sources that I saw, I don't know how definitive this is, but there are some sources that say that Kolomoisky, who was the billionaire patron of Zelensky, was the real owner of Burisma behind the scenes. But Zolochevsky was, or however you pronounce it, was the official owner of it. And he had been tight with the government that was overthrown at the beginning of 2014. So the question was, oh no, is the weight of the government now going to come to bear against him as a friend of the old regime? So to try to suck up, he went straight to hire the vice president's son, wow, right? Go over the head of the new regime and hire their patrons to sit on the board. He also hired Kofor Black, the head of CIA counterterrorism, who failed to stop September 11th and let Osama bin Laden escape in 2001. And then he also brought in a former Polish prime minister as well. I forget his name off the top of my head. How to say it right enough for you anyway. But so he hired all those guys to sit on the board essentially as protection from the new government so that the new government would not persecute them. And then so when you read all the emails in the Hunter Biden laptop, he's going back and forth with the leadership at like the right hand man of the CEO of Burisma. And the whole thing is, we hired you to take care of this problem for us, and we're waiting for you to get Washington to intervene with Kiev to get the hell off our back. And so hurry up. And he says, don't worry, we're hiring Sally Painter, who's the same lady who did a bunch of PR for NATO expansion back in the 1990s for Bill Clinton back then. We hired Sally Painter, the PR whiz, to come in here and to lobby on our behalf in Washington and to help put all this thing together, whatever. You could read all that in the laptop. The same one that the FBI already had possession of and completely stifled all knowledge of during the impeachment of Donald Trump in January of 2020. So now I'm sure Benz is really onto something there. I'd have to go back and look at exactly what he's written and said about all of that. I think my understanding was that it's not the quantity of natural gas available in eastern Ukraine is not enough to make or break anyone. It's really about the transit of Russian gas across Ukraine and how much money they get and whether they're getting any or not. And there's also, well, first of all, we should talk about these rare earths. They're basically mythological. There's this great article, you should look it up. It's in Bloomberg, where this guy says, you know, the U.S. Geological Study ranks all the nation states with rare earths in the world, and Ukraine's not even on the list, and they're just way down. They have a very, very small amounts of these minerals and hardly worth mining over, and I know most of all the best of their mining and everything is in the east. That's why it's called the Donbass. It's a portmanteau for the Donetsk coal basin is what it means, is because it was actually two Brits who founded Donetsk and Luhansk cities there as mining operations back in the 20th century.
You're saying that it's safe to say that if the border that is settled on during this peace negotiation is where it is currently at after the conflict, that Russia would have possession of the majority of Ukraine's rare earth minerals anyway.
I think so. And I guess there's this province called Dipronoska Flippa-Floppa, something or other there, right between the river and Donetsk, that, you know, supposedly has some as well. And there's also a lot of farmland there. People don't talk about this as much, but Archer Daniels Midland, Monsanto, and Cargill also have major interest there since the Obama years in buying up all those wheat fields. It's the breadbasket of Europe. Russia and Ukraine both supply a huge percentage of the grain to mostly the global south. You know, remember the big French yellow vest protests and all of that? Was it the yellow vest ones, or it was after the yellow vest? More recent farmer protests there.
Right.
They were protesting for protection against Ukrainian grain that was being shipped across Europe because they couldn't get it out of the Black Sea. So it was being shipped to Europe instead, and it was depressing their sale prices there.
Wow.
They were demanding protection from that cheaper grain coming in from Ukraine was at the root of that. So, as we were agreeing here, we don't want to give them a half-assed security guarantee in the form of a deal to take these minerals from them. It's hardly worth it. And it puts us on the hook for the war guarantee that we weren't willing to give them in the first place. Right. Rightly so. And even Joe Biden himself said in his exit interview in Time magazine, he goes, "I'm the guy who said they can't join NATO." Well, actually, what he said was, kind of, he said that. He said they can't join NATO, but Russia can't say that they can't join NATO. So I officially say that, yeah, they can too. Just not now, but maybe someday. And I refuse to sign a deal that says that they can't. That was what he said. And that was a huge part of what caused the war.
So I think we have a pretty good like base level here, framework for moving into this next clip. One of the first clips of the actual exchange. So we'll go ahead and pull that up now.
About security guarantees and about just ceasefire. We can't just speak about ceasefire and speak and speak. It will not work. Just ceasefire will not never work, because I'm like a president. I have this experience, and not only me. Ukraine before my presidency, from the 2014 Putin broken 25 times. 25 times he broken his own signature. 25 times he broken ceasefire.
He never broke to me.
No, you were the president.
He never broke to me.
In 2016, you won't been the president, Mr. President. You've been the president, but of course, not with you, but he had, during those period, he had conversations with our side. And we had Normandy format, you know, the France, Germany, Ukraine, and Russia. And he broken 25 times. That's why we will never accept just ceasefire. It will not work without security guarantees. Security guarantees, maybe President is right about this document and other, but this document is not enough. Strong army is enough, because his soldiers afraid, Putin's soldiers afraid of our soldiers when we...
Yeah, 25 times.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, that's not true. I mean, if he's counting every... I don't know what he's pretending to count there. I don't know. Like, I never saw an article that said here's 25. You know, certainly maybe someone's trying to write one at Vox.com now or something. But look, he's right that the Minsk II deal was never truly implemented. But that's mostly on the Ukraine side rather than the Russian side for refusing to implement their side of the peace deal. And so anyway, what's most important about that context, so people understand, besides just the oddity of him attempting to shout Trump down and speak over him in that way and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Is you heard him use the word never there. He said, we do not want to negotiate a ceasefire with Russia. In other words, and he goes on at different times, you know, all the different quotes, but what he's saying essentially is, we won't settle for anything less than winning the war. Russia has to lose the war. And then after they lose the war, then I need you to give me a war guarantee that if they ever try it again, that you'll come and fight for me again. Well, both of those things are completely crazy and stupid and wrong. And he has to know that. Yeah. It can't work. It had to have been a deliberate decision to snap at Vance the way he did and say, listen, enough of this talk about diplomacy. You can't negotiate with a guy who breaks deals. Mm-hmm. And so again, implying, and even after Trump says, yeah, but he ain't ever broke a deal with me. He's like, essentially just ignores that and says, yeah, but he did before and after you, and is going to again and does all the time and whatever. And so he's saying, essentially, I reject your attempt to end the war. I'm here to sign maybe a mineral deal with you, but no, I do not co-sign you going to Moscow and making a peace deal. Now, this is the same dynamic in Afghanistan, right? Bush and Obama both said, yeah, we will negotiate with the Taliban. Only a political solution can end the war, but we're bringing Kabul with us on any talks. Well, Kabul needs us to stay in the war, and they need the war for us to stay in. And so, no, they don't want peace with the Taliban. They want America to stay and fight for them for as long as possible. So it's the same kind of thing here, and the same kind of thing happened in Vietnam. You might know the story where Nixon and Kissinger hired a lady named Anna Chenault to go and expose and warn the South Vietnamese that Johnson was secretly negotiating with the North behind their back. Mm. And then they, once they found out, they screwed that deal up. And based on that treason, Nixon was elected in 1968. So it's the same kind of dynamic here, where this is why you don't even invite Kiev along and you just make the deal without them. Except that in this situation, it's a bit different than Vietnam and Afghanistan, in the sense that Ukraine still has a state army. And without American help, they can hang in there at least for a while. You know, and so they're not, you know, just waiting to be toppled immediately, sitting on top of a completely phony and illegitimate state like in Afghanistan and in Vietnam, in Kabul and Saigon. So, so that is the card that Zelensky has to play, and he's playing it, right? He's saying, listen, I'm not going along with any peace deal. I'm going to keep fighting. So you can't make a peace deal without me. And so Trump's hardball kind of blew up in his face here, because he's insulting the guy and calling him a dictator and threatening that, look, I'm not going to back you. I'm not going to give you any more money. I'm not going to give you any more weapons. He didn't have to say all that, Mr. You know, hold my cards close to my chest while I'm making a deal or whatever. Not this time. Mm-hmm. He went and telegraphed that, like, look, Zelensky, I don't have your back, so loudly and so definitively that Zelensky apparently decided, well, look, if you don't have me, if you're not going to back me up anyway, then I'm going to go ahead and make a big show of breaking with you and beating my chest and acting tough and trying to get Europe to back me then. Hmm. And I'll have them take like the Biden position that, oh no, Donald Trump is this terrible right winger who's doing this terrible isolationist turn away from freedom. And so they have to now pick up the banner and pick up the cudgel on behalf of the West and help and go finish the war. And then, so that was why Zelensky then went straight to Britain to try to get them on board to continue the thing. But the reality is that the Europeans don't have the military force to back Ukraine without America. They don't even have the logistics capability or anything else to actually wage anything like a war there or a real resupply effort. The Brits are talking about boots and planes. They didn't mean actual like British men standing on corners with combat boots. They meant, we'll send you some boots.
Yeah, actual boots.
We'll send you some planes.
We're
that's
back
what
to Obama then, right? It's the bedsheet thing, right? And all that. It's just like, we're going to support you, but it's like a vague promise. It has nothing to do with that.
And they said, we know that we can't without America to backstop it. Well, look, if we were willing to fight for Ukraine, we'd be fighting for Ukraine right now. We're not. That's it. Even Joe Biden said, that's World War III, man. We're not going to fight them. We're just going to help Ukraine fight them. But we're not putting our soldiers in there. I mean, we do have special operations forces there doing some advising and so forth, but not truly conducting battles or participating in direct fighting, I don't believe, because as Biden said, that's completely crazy. We're not doing that. And so that's it. That's what we're up against, is the Russians have hydrogen bombs. And so America can't go to war with them because that risks spiraling out of control and raising the risk of thermonuclear annihilation of all a northern civilization off the planet Earth and everything our ancestors built over the last 5,000 years. So instead of that, we're going to not do that. Instead of that, F the Donbass. Nobody cares. Right. Guess what, Donetsk? Nobody cares whether you're ruled by Kiev or by Moscow. And so that's just how it's going to be. And that's the way it was always going to be. Again, Joe Biden had said, we are not sending the 82nd Airborne. Actually, he one time said we are, but he didn't mean it. And that was a flub.
That was a Biden moment, you know,
that
for
was
sure.
A Biden moment.
He didn't have all the right drugs that day.
So we've got another clip here. I think that we're set up to move on to where Zelensky kind of accuses Trump of aligning too much with Putin.
Well, it's actually a Polish reporter, which is really an instigator here. If you watch the full thing, he's the one who asked the last question that we just saw.
Right.
He asked this question. I actually played the question this time because I think it shows the setup. And a lot of people are accusing like Vance and Trump of having set this up. But I think this Polish reporter is actually the bad actor in the room. Check it out. You got to see it.
Okay.
And they are worried that you align yourself too much with Putin. What's your message for them?
Well, if I didn't align myself with both of them, you'd never have a deal. You want me to say really terrible things about Putin and then say, hi, Vladimir, how are we doing on the deal? That doesn't work that way. I'm not aligned with Putin. I'm not aligned with anybody. I'm aligned with the United States of America. And for the good of the world, I'm aligned with the world. And I want to get this thing over with. You see the hatred he's got for Putin. It's very tough for me to make a deal with that kind of hate. He's got tremendous hatred. And I understand that. But I can tell you the other side isn't exactly in love with, you know, him either. So it's not a question of alignment. I'm aligned with the world. I want to get the thing set. I'm aligned with Europe. I want to see if we can get this thing done. You want me to be tough? I could be tougher than any human being you've ever seen. I'd be so tough. But you're never going to get a deal that way. So that's the way it goes. All right, one more question.
I will respond to this. So look, for 4 years in the United States of America, we had a president who stood up at press conferences and talked tough about Vladimir Putin. And then Putin invaded Ukraine and destroyed a significant chunk of the country. The path to peace and the path to prosperity is maybe engaging in diplomacy. We tried the pathway of Joe Biden of thumping our chest and pretending that the President of the United States' words mattered more than the President of the United States' actions. What makes America a good country is America engaging in diplomacy. That's what President Trump is doing.
Can I ask you?
So you think the framework, Scott, that Biden was all talk and Trump is action is an accurate way to approach this?
Well, yeah, I'm not really sure that was the perfect way for Vance to phrase that. I mean, what he was trying to say, the first part of it was right, that Biden saying you better not was not enough to change anything, right? But he's saying, yeah, so what we need is action, not words, and that's why we're gonna go over there and sit down at a table and talk with them. Well, no, that's, yeah, what we need is a reasonable policy, not this stupidity. And so, you know, I think what he's really sort of implying there is that Trump is such a tough and scary guy that nobody's going to mess with him, and he'll be able to get a good deal, and the other side will stick with it. And this kind of a deal that he's seeking America's national interests here, and quite frankly, Ukraine's interests over their leadership's wishes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I agree with you. That was kind of a clumsy way that he summed that up at the end. But essentially what he was saying was all this kind of posturing didn't work. And by the way, so let's focus on that for a second. So this is how the war began, was Biden would say to Russia, you better not, but he would not negotiate with them in good faith in order to reassure them of a couple of things so that they wouldn't. And it really is frustrating. You know, Justin Logan from Cato back years ago in the, must have been in the W. Bush years, coined the phrase, the fallacy of 39, which essentially says that Neville Chamberlain and Britain should have launched the war against Germany sooner rather than waiting. And that everything is Munich and everything is a compromise with Hitler that never really works. And so that on that basis, you have to attack Saddam now, you have to attack him 12 years later, you have to, build up the NATO alliance to face down any potential rivals in Europe and, you know, essentially all of these things. And that in this case, in the war, by looking at it through this, this sort of escalatory deterrence model or dictator deterrence model, which they all say the same thing. No, you have to punch a bully in the nose, because right, they're all nerds who needed someone to punch their bully in the nose for them. So that's their life experience there. And they don't realize that most of the time they're the ones who are the bullies, you know? Mm. But before the war, Stephen Walt from Harvard, who's, you know, one of the deans of the Realist School of Foreign Policy, he said, listen, you guys are essentially just, I'm paraphrasing him, but essentially you guys are on the wrong page of the textbook. This is not Hitler and Neville Chamberlain at Czechoslovakia. What's going on here is it's the spiral model of international conflict where both sides actually have defensive ideas in mind and project only aggression and offense on the other side. Mm-hmm. And neither side is willing to back down on anything because they call that appeasement when in fact what they're doing is they're refusing to be flexible at all in a way that's only guaranteeing an unnecessary conflict. And in fact, the new Hitler wasn't coming until you kind of created the situation that turned him into one. And so that's what's going on here, is that, as he put it, yes, appeasement. We could sign a treaty where we say we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO. We could sign a treaty where we say, well, we will never deploy these Mark 41 missile launchers in Kharkiv that can hold anti-missile missiles, but can also hold Tomahawk cruise missiles, both of which are seen as a threat to Russia. So by Russia. So we could do that and we could appease him, and that would prevent the war. Because after all, as Walt said, Ukraine matters a hell of a lot more to Russia than it does to us. They are willing to put their troops in there and fight for it. We are not. So that already being the situation, this is before the war, he wrote this in foreignpolicy.com. That already being the situation, we ought to find a way to just get along here and sign a deal. We could prevent this war from happening. And Biden, you know, absolutely refused to do that. He would talk tough, as Vance is saying there. He would talk tough, but he would not negotiate. And so what Vance really meant to say there was, this president has the wisdom to see when it's not worth getting into a fight. And this is one that could have been avoided, and it can be resolved now if we try hard, instead of this kind of idiocy that you're hearing from Zelensky here. And this is the part where, when he says that, is when he says, oh, come on, JD.
Yeah, we'll play that in a second. So one of the things I wanted to note that I think a lot of the MAGA supporters actually miss is the degree to which Trump's tough talk set up the war too, such as arms sales that maybe were miscalibrated. That's or whatever. Part of it. To actually create the conditions for Russia to want to invade.
And his ambassador, William Taylor, also sabotaged a peace deal. It was called the Steinmeier formula, proposed by the German foreign minister for a new order of operations that hopefully everyone could agree on for implementing the strictures of the Minsk II peace deal. And Ambassador William Taylor told them, don't sign that. That's a terrible idea. Steinmeier doesn't even know what it is. You shouldn't do it. And I don't know if Trump knows about that or not, or ordered him to do it or not, but it's his responsibility for having that guy as his ambassador who did that. And I'd like to know more about that and whether that was the White House who ordered him to do that or not. I know, you know, this was right around the time that Trump was denouncing the Germans for doing the Nord Stream deal and saying that the Russians were making dependents and suckers out of them. And that they ought to buy that natural gas from Ted Cruz's home state of Texas instead.
So we'll keep playing here and get the next part with Zelensky.
Where I'm from too, by the way, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So he occupied it, our parts, big parts of Ukraine, part of East and Crimea. So he occupied it on 2014. So during a lot of years, so I'm not speaking about just Biden, but those time was Obama, then President Obama, then President Trump, then President Biden, now the President Trump, and God bless, now President Trump will stop him. But during 2014, nobody stopped him. He just occupied and took. He killed people. You know what the contact was?
2015.
2014.
2014.
Yeah, yeah. So
I was not here.
Yeah, but
that's exactly right.
Yes, but during 2014 till 2022, yeah, the same. Well, the situation the same? The people have been dying on the contact line. Nobody stopped him. You know that we had conversations with him, a lot of conversations, my bilateral conversation, and we signed with him. Me, like a new president in 2019, I signed with him the deal. I signed with him, Macron and Merkel, we signed ceasefire. Ceasefire, all of them told me that he will never go. We signed him with gas contract. Yes, but after that, he broken this ceasefire. He killed our people and he didn't exchange prisoners. We signed the exchange of prisoners, but he didn't do it. What kind of diplomacy? JD, you are speaking about what do you mean?
Right. So yeah, here he's calling Trump and Vance fools. He's saying you can't negotiate with this guy, and of course he's not taking responsibility for all the fighting on both sides during the so-called low-level civil war there.
that's what I want to ask you about, because like I think the Minsk Accords themselves are not well understood by the American public at all.
Yeah.
Right. And when he's mentioning all the negotiations and stuff like that, they're just hearing, oh, well, they talked at some point. They're not hearing like formal peace things that on a two-sided thing. He kind of frames it like they invaded us in 2014 and we were just like, just stood around and didn't do it. I don't know.
What the heck, man?
Yeah. Right. So what actually happened in the Donbass at those times that in the Minsk Accords around that conflict? Because it was a two-sided conflict, right?
Sure. So, I mean, it's a complicated mess, but I'll skip this part of it. But just to say that the Obama government, Obama and Biden and their government led the overthrow of the government of Ukraine in 2014. And really, they were trying to marginalize the president and get their government appointed under him, their prime minister and all their staff to really run the government. And they were going to essentially kick him out of the way and force him to hold new elections. But then once they had even got him to agree to that deal, which the Russians, it was Vladimir Putin who insisted that he sign the deal and give in to the Americans, by the way. Then the Nazis, who were leading the protest movement that America had been supporting all that time, they said, not good enough for us. The president has to leave town by 10 o'clock in the morning tomorrow, or we're going to kill him ourselves. And so, and part of the agreement was that they would pull their troops, their police back and special operations guys and whoever back in order. And then the protesters were supposed to go home too, but that didn't happen. They just ended up sacking the whole city, all the government buildings and taking it over, and forcing the president to leave town. So that was the overthrow of 2014. So in reaction to that, Putin seized the Crimean Peninsula, which includes the city and the naval base at Sevastopol, which are extremely important to Russia and belong to Russia since the 1780s, since 1783, in fact, the same year America was making peace with Britain at the end of the Revolutionary War. And it had only been given to Crimea by the Soviet dictator Khrushchev in 1954. After Stalin died, it was a gift to the Ukrainian Communist Party to shore up support so he could succeed Stalin as the new general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. So you see why his edict is holy writ there, when really Crimea had always belonged to Russia and was populated by a supermajority Russian population since the Great War against the Turks way back in the 18th century. So then after the Russians seized the Crimean Peninsula, the new regime in Kiev, which had been immediately recognized by the United States and egged on by the United States at the explicit instruction, in fact, of CIA Director John Brennan, the same guy who backed Al-Qaeda in Syria till it blew up into the caliphate, the same guy who later framed Trump for treason with Russia in the Russiagate hoax. He went there and insisted that the new regime launch a civil war against the protesters in the East who had seized the government buildings and were refusing to give them up. Now, everybody says it was the Russians who were behind all this, and there were some Russians involved, but they didn't really come until later. It was an organic thing where the protesters seized all the buildings. And I have all the timeline in my book where I show that, you know, the Russian, a few like Russian so-called volunteers, like obviously intelligence assets, kind of rushed to get in the front of that parade and take credit for it and things like that. But they had not committed any overt act of war. I mean, the worst thing they had done was occupy the national police buildings and stuff like that. And then John Brennan insisted that Kiev attack them. And that was the launch of the what they call the anti-terrorist operation, including airstrikes and artillery and tanks and full-scale war. And so then a huge part of the military defected to the other side. And that was, you know, the worst of the war. They blame that all on Russia. They pretend that was all Russian invasion and Russian weapons or whatever. It was Ukrainian weapons or Soviet weapons that had been left with Ukraine that was now divided against itself and fighting. And I mean, I have all the citations in there from the Conflicts Armaments Research NGO, as well as C.J. Chivers, I think you say it, from the New York Times, who's a former Marine officer and armaments expert who's been all around the world analyzing which weapons came from where, and said, you know, these are clearly Soviet weapons that have belonged to the Ukrainian government that defectors took with them when they went to the other side in what was a pretty horrific civil war that killed about 9,000 people between March of 14 and February of 15. Now, the Russians did intervene outright in August of 14 and in February of 15. You know, there are all these claims of Russian invasions and Russian troops. There may have been some volunteers here or there, but there's plenty of reporting about how these were local guys. These were local militiamen and former military guys, former police who had signed up to lead these militias and fight in the war. And then, but after the Russians intervened outright on their side in August of 14, that really forced Kiev to the deal, and they signed the Minsk I peace deal. And later, like 2 weeks later, they added an addendum that had a little bit more specific strictures. But this is essentially, this deal essentially mandated that they pull back their heavy forces. No more airstrikes, no more tanks. And they created a new kind of no man's land, as he called it, the contact line there. Supposed to be the no contact line, separating the two. And then in,
is that a bit of a dip of the hat, like him calling it the contact line rather than the no contact line? It's like the demilitarized zone. They're calling it, well, this is where we militarize. I mean,
you never really know with military jargon, but yeah, point taken. But then, so I guess the restrictions weren't enough, or they weren't clear enough, and some things needed to be added and adjusted. So after the Russians intervened again at Debaltseve or something very close to how you say that, in February of 15, that was when they came and did Minsk II. And so now at Minsk II, more or less held in the sense of restricting the war down to what we call low level fighting. So we had 9,000 die in the first, 11 months of the war. And we had 4,000 die over the next 7 years. If that makes sense to you, right? It's still a pretty high level war if you're the one getting shelled. But it was the tempo had been turned way down from before. And remember, of course, it was apparently it's not 1,000%, but quite apparently it was a Russian backed militia. I think this part is not in dispute. The question is where they got the missile. They may have stolen it from the Kiev military. They may have been given it by the Russians. It's not 100% clear, I don't believe, but it was apparently a local rebel militia, as they call them, that shot down the Malaysian Airlines flight over the Donbass over Donetsk in I believe it was July of 2014. And so that was a horrific error, which of course they turned into a massive public relations campaign against Putin, like he had ordered them to shoot down this plane himself full of civilians, when what it was a terrible error by amateur warriors, volunteer militiamen, essentially, out over their skis, accidentally shooting down a civilian airliner. Why? Because they've been taking shots at Ukrainian military jets that have been bombing them for days. Mm-hmm. They thought it was another one. So that was why they were firing surface-to-air missiles there. It wasn't to try to kill a bunch of Dutch and Malaysian civilians on their way from here to there, right? Mm-hmm. It was an attempt to protect themselves from the Kiev regime that was striking them from the air. Now, what that should mean to people, what you should understand by that, is especially when it doesn't matter who's doing the bombing. When it's airstrikes against small groups on the ground, they don't know who they're bombing, right? They do not have good enough intelligence to tell them who they're killing. So it's not exactly carpet bombing at random, but nor is it precision strikes with a scalpel like they used to like to pretend to say about Obama's drones that only kill innocent, only kill guilty people. It wasn't true for them either. But without good intel on the ground, you don't know who you're bombing. And so that meant that they were a lot of times bombing innocent people on the ground as well. So anyway, so those were the Minsk deals. And then the problem is that through the rest of Obama and then through all 4 years of Trump, America never insisted that Kiev implement the Minsk deals. And now Kiev said that we don't have to implement Minsk until the Russians essentially give up the entire field to their accusation that like all of the rebels are the Russians. And so essentially they have anyone fighting in the East has to stop fighting and they have to return all of control of the Donbass, including all of the border posts on the Ukrainian-Russian border has to all be turned over to Kiev first. And because, hey, you can't have a free election under occupation, which they kind of got a point there, but that was the deal they signed. It was Germany and France that negotiated the thing, but America and the UN Security Council all put their rubber stamps on it and all. So that was the deal. And so the both sides refused to implement that. And that was where we get back to what I was calling the Steinmeier formula before, where the German foreign minister tried to come up with a compromise to get them to figure out a new order of operations that people could agree on to implement the different, I keep saying strictures, what's the vocabulary word I'm looking for? The different bullet points on the damn page of what they're supposed to do there. And then the Trump government sabotaged that and then continued, as you said, to continue to send weapons and, you know, in the middle of a war, right? So this wasn't deterring Russia. There's already a civil war where the Russians are not so low key backing one side the whole time. I mean, he's wrong to say, oh, they just moved in. They took this land in 2014. All this, if he's referring to Crimea, yeah, but he's conflating all of the rebels fighting in the Donbass with Russian regular forces occupying and seizing territory, which is just not true at all. And then he's saying that the fact that Minsk II was never fully implemented is 100% the fault of the Russians and all the fighting that ever took place during the so-called low-level fighting, that was all Russians. And every time that something fell apart, every time a side negotiation deal fell apart, that was all because they were the dishonest player in this. Well, but look who's telling the story,
right?
He's clearly telling his own side of that. When the reality is, again, it was the Obama government that intervened violating the Budapest Memorandum, which doesn't just say that we promise not to invade your country. It also says we promise to respect the sovereignty of your national government and not meddle in any overt or covert way in your politics either. And the Americans were the ones who violated that, who forced the crisis in Crimea and then forced the crisis in the Donbass. And so this was, you know, the two major issues in the run-up to the war was America repeatedly vowing from W. Bush through Obama, Trump, and Biden that America would bring Ukraine into NATO. I don't know if Trump ever said that, but his government did say that. Mike Pompeo said that in a speech in Georgia, I believe it was, that this is all still going to happen. And of course, under Biden, they loudly proclaimed that Ukraine will be in NATO someday. And we will get them into a war in the name of that principle. And then the other issue was the ongoing civil war in the Donbass, which America had all the power in the world to get the Kiev government to give up and to wrap up and figure out a compromise that, you know, under the deal, the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts there, as they call their giant provinces there, or their counties and major size counties, in their country, they were essentially pushing for statehood. They were pushing for strong federalism, but they were not declaring full independence and sovereignty in their own nation state at that time. And nor were they being allowed by Russia to join the Russian Federation after they voted for quote unquote sovereignty, but not exactly independence in 2014. Their leaders asked to join the Russian Federation and Putin told them no. He was working on a deal with the Germans. He did not want to absorb the Donbass. They were more trouble than they were worth. And America just made it, you know, change that calculation where now it's more trouble to not go ahead and invade. And so he made that calculation instead.
It's been very peculiar to me that that's so missing from the narrative from the other side is the Donbass voting to leave, right? And how we're like, well, we gotta replay them all back to the borders. It's like, well, what if they don't want to? Those would be the borders, like the people who actually live there, right? That's that libertarian instinct that most people just lack, that, hey, you know, just because you're part of a larger group doesn't mean you want to be part of that larger group.
And they just lie about it, by the way. They say, oh, that's just not true at all, that the people had any differing opinion from everybody in Lviv or whatever. That's just not true. And Keith Gessen, who is a reporter for the New York Times and a bunch of other places, New York Review of Books and wherever other places I've read him, he was there and he's like, man, hundreds of thousands of people came out to vote for sovereignty, not full independence, but to break away from Kiev. or to insist on that strong federalism in those elections. He was there and watched the whole thing. And that's, you know, against interest, because that was not the New York Times or Obama administration narrative at the time. It was just true.
Yeah. So we'll dive into the next part here where it gets even spicier as we go.
I'm talking about the kind of diplomacy that's going to end the destruction of your country.
Yes, but if you
Mr. President, with respect, I think it's disrespectful for you to come into the Oval Office and try to litigate this in front of the American media. Right now, you guys are going around and forcing conscripts to the front lines because you have manpower problems. You should be thanking the president for trying to bring an end to this conflict.
Have you ever been to Ukraine? Did you say what problems we have?
I have been to...
Come on.
I've actually watched and seen the stories, and I know what happens is you bring people, you bring them on a propaganda tour, Mr. President. Do you disagree that you've had problems bringing people into your military?
We have problems.
And do you think that it's respectful to come to the Oval Office of the United States of America and attack the administration that is trying to prevent the destruction of your country?
A lot of questions.
Yeah, so propaganda tours is interesting, especially because it's definitely one of those moments where you gotta believe they want to deny your eyes, right? I'm watching these videos of these guys getting taken off the streets. We actually covered when they had it was terrible. It showed like a row of Ukrainian soldiers, and one of them was very obviously had Down syndrome, and you're like, and like the older men mm-hmm. getting picked up off the street, especially.
Forced into vehicles and driven away to wherever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so it is crazy that he would have the chutzpah in that moment, just be like, that's not a problem, you know? Yeah.
What are your thoughts there, Scott?
There's a few things. I mean, first of all, just the nerve of him to sit there and go back and forth with these guys when he's the client and they're the patron, and it's as simple as that. And he's just going to say, no, wrong, you don't know what you're talking about, to the vice president like that. Well,
that's the part of the Rorschach test that's so interesting here, because the way the left is interpreting this, and I watched Chris Hayes on this earlier today, you know, my eyes are bleeding, and it was crazy to watch it. Like the way they frame is like these two equal presidents got together as if we're not funding everything they're doing, and Trump was kind of, it was rude. That's the way they're framing it.
Yeah.
As opposed to the actual relationship here.
Yeah, it can't be specific. Yeah, what was happening there? Our side is calling for a ceasefire, and the Ukrainians are saying, no, we will not accept a ceasefire. We don't want a ceasefire. We won't accept your negotiating peace on our behalf. We want to keep fighting. And Trump's saying, well, screw you then. You're not getting our weapons. And he's saying, you're damn fools, the two of you, for thinking that you can negotiate with Russia anyway. So Chris Hayes can't tell you that that's what's going on in the scene, because then you'll take Trump and Vance's side. So instead he says, oh, geez, I clucked my tongue over, never mind the context here of who's in whose Oval Office and who's the actual alpha dog in the room who gets to call shots and who is the supplicant. It's just ridiculous. But the thing about it, too, is, what was I going to say? I'm sorry, I got distracted on the stupidity of the way that he's going back and forth with him about it. But I'm trying to remember what it was that he was actually, what he specifically said in that clip that I was going to contradict there. I got what Biden's got. You got to let me off the hook.
It's all right. Well, JD's like, we're trying to prevent the destruction of your country, you know, and he...
Oh, it was about the conscription. Right. It was about the conscription. Thank you. So the thing is, Vance is mostly right there, but it's like worth delving into the situation with the conscription. Okay, so in the country they've had millions of people flee to just avoid the fighting altogether, and then they have already been in a demographic crisis, and now they're in one of the most severe in the world, and they've been sending their middle-aged guys to fight. And a lot of times people look at that and say, oh my God, they already ran out of young men and they're only sending middle-aged guys to the front now. But no, that's not what it is. They're sending the middle-aged guys to fight because they're trying to hold their reproduction age males in reserve and hopefully give them time to get somebody pregnant before they go out and get blown up on the front line. And because their society is just completely being destroyed by this. And so what they're doing is their conscription age, the minimum is 25. Mm. And they're sending middle-aged guys out to the front to fight, and they're holding their younger guys back to do logistics and sort of reserve, back-end stuff for the war. And this is why Lindsey Graham's been over there. Oh, and you're absolutely correct to say you've seen videos of guys being, impressed into service by gangs of recruits, just beat them up and throw them in the back of a van and kidnap them and take them off the street or out of a club or a restaurant, wherever they go out in public, sometimes come to their houses and rouse them and take them. The New York Times and the Independent and many others have covered how thousands of men had tried to flee across the Western River, the Dnieper, into Transdniester. It goes by different names, the Dniester River. And there's a couple there in Western Ukraine, and they're drowning, trying to escape across the border, across the river, to safe haven from conscription there. And that's true. And there's been, a lot of reporting about that, of, some guys make it, but some guys drown. It's really treacherous waters, to try to cross. And then Lindsey Graham goes over there, and he's not alone, but he goes over there and stomps his foot and says, I can't believe that your conscription age is only 25. It should be 18, and you should be sending your 18-year-olds to the front. How in the hell do you ever expect to win this war if you're not willing to send all your 18-year-olds to the front to win? And the answer was, because they're losing either way, and they're desperately trying to save their 25-year-olds who are, are still of family creation age before getting them killed on a fool's errand in the East, where the whole thing is completely stupid anyway. So isn't that funny how I can never remember what I was just thinking, but I can remember all that stuff that I read from
it happens to me all the time.
But yeah, so that's what it is. And that's why you see Lindsey Graham saying, lower your conscription age. You might think that it was already 18 and like, what are you going to lower it to 14? Yeah. You know what I mean? But no, the reality is it's too high. They're sending old men. They're sending guys in their 50s and 60s out there to fight. Take this rucksack and run over there. And the guy's like, oh, I got diabetes and a bad knee. I'm like, why? What are you doing? It's crazy. So unfair. And I actually did see one report about a guy with Down syndrome, but I couldn't tell how verified it was. So I didn't run with that one, but I did see at least one report of that.
Yeah, it's just absolutely so tragic. And I can't wrap my head around what Zelensky's mindset is here. He seems so hell-bent on continuing this war, yet the long-term look at this, outside of his sort of short-sighted view of having to continue this fight for whatever reason, is just the complete destruction of his country, both from infrastructure standpoint, but also from the demographics that you talk about. How can he possibly be thinking about this, thinking about himself as the leader of this country, thinking about the longevity here? Is he thinking about that at all, or is he just absolutely laser-focused on a war he can't win?
I mean, I guess the calculation is that might as well keep fighting now because it's only going to be worse later, kind of thing, right? I think I hear this a lot from people say, well, Putin is just trying to recreate the Russian Empire. So if he wants a ceasefire now, it's just to stop and rearm and rebuild his forces so he can come back and take more or worse later. I just don't think that's true. I think it's, these people want to assume their premise so that they can acquit the American side for all that they did to instigate this conflict. When in reality, we just make it clear, we're not moving our alliance any closer to your country. We're not going to bring Ukraine in. We're not going to station military forces there. They could have said, hell, we'll even knock off all of this training. Under that circumstance, we could probably even keep selling them weapons as long as we're not instructing them on how to be just another auxiliary army under NATO's supreme allied command in the event of a war between NATO and the Russian Federation. Because, this is where, Napoleon and the Germans twice came across Ukraine. I think Napoleon also came across the Baltics, but all three major times they were invaded from the West in recent history, it was through the steppes of Ukraine. And it's, the Russians have no hills, no mountains, no rivers, no real natural defenses in their west whatsoever. It's just wide open plain for armies to cross to get straight to Moscow, straight to St. Petersburg. And so this is a huge part of why Stalin held on to all of Eastern Europe after the Second World War, is all cushion to protect him from Western invasion, either by Germany, the United States, or both. You know, yeah, you don't have to agree with it at all to recognize Russia's security posture here. They're just not going to tolerate this level of, especially foreign superpower intervention right on their doorstep. In fact, look at a map. You see the Baltics and Belarus, and then it hooks east big time where Ukraine is under, you know, directly, you know, Kharkiv is what, 300-400 miles from Moscow. It's just right there. And so from their point of view, this is soft underbelly stuff, right? This is their strategic depth and we're trying to take it away. And, you know, it comes up so often that I sometimes forget to bring it up because I'm like, oh, it's too cliche. And I don't know, but it makes the most sense. I think should be like the basic elevator pitch here for this part of the argument is, imagine that Ronald Reagan had spent us all into bankruptcy and it was the American empire who had broken in the brinksmanship of the 1980s. And so we had to come home from Europe and we lost our world empire. And now we've got the Russians have expanded the Warsaw Pact and world communism into the West, and including conquered Great Britain and France and Spain and Portugal and the rest. And now they're moving on the Caribbean and integrating Mexico. And now they overthrow the government of Canada twice in 10 years because they keep voting wrong against the pro-Russian candidate. And then the second time they use a bunch of Hitler-loving Nazis to do it. And then they immediately declare war against the people of British Columbia out there in Vancouver who form militias and refuse to recognize the legitimacy of the new pro-Russian government. All the while they threaten to kick us out of our naval bases in Alaska. Well, what do you think the United States would do in a situation like that? And the answer is we would threaten them and then we would invade Canada and probably nuke Moscow. That's the answer. And everybody knows it. There's no question about that. In fact, a journalist named Christopher Lane put this question to some generals that he was talking to, apparently on multiple occasions. I need to go back and reread this thing. I keep telling myself that and I keep forgetting. But apparently, like on a few different occasions, he set them up really well. Like he didn't ask it like it was the first part of a two-part question or something. He asked it like it was just a straight question. What would we do? Do we have a strategic plan on the shelf or whatever? What would be America's posture if China moved to support pro-Chinese parties in Mexico? And then they established a pro-Chinese regime in Mexico City, which then invited them, quote unquote, to build military bases on our border. And the generals all say first threats, then sanctions, then invasion, and probably nuke Beijing.
Right.
Right. And then Lane says to them, how do you think the Russians feel about us in Ukraine? And according to Lane, they all say, oh, wow, dude, far out. Like I totally never thought of that before.
They stumbled upon strategic empathy.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So like. So we're like the Chinese,
Yeah.
Right? And then, yeah, dude, the baddies, of course. Right?
To put it in
I'm the baddies.
Like, yeah, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it's taking Putin's side or rationalizing him or any of his actual sins and evils he's committed to say that the guy is not a Soviet communist. And you know, I mean, after Stalin, the rest of the guys, as bloody handed as they were, could at least be, you know, mostly right. Dealt with. But this guy essentially is not a romantic. He's a clerk, right? He's a bureaucrat. Now, he's the top clerk. He has, you know, official responsibilities here of a very high order, and he knows that. But he is essentially a technocrat who wants to see things work. And has always looked at a partnership with the United States as in Russia's best interest. And so, you know, they call him this monster, but I think it's probably good that he's such a sociopath that he doesn't really have emotions like regular guys who might get upset. He doesn't really get upset. He just goes, look, you know, I'm going to kill these people and whatever, but like, yeah. It's all business. And if you want to make an arrangement and we can understand each other, then fine. And he, I don't know about very lately, but for 20 years, he always said our American partners this and our American partners that. Because after all, he's in the position right. of weakness. Like, what's he going to do? Go on in the world with, you know, being an adversary of the United States of America? What's yeah. the mileage in that? Only makes sense for him to try to get along with us.
Right. And who's like, hey, you guys owe me this at this point, right? Like, at minimum, he's acknowledging right. the actual power differential.
And so, but the American stance was, well, that's fine, but we're going to do whatever we want anyway. And if you don't like it, well, what are you going to do about it? So you can want to be our friend, but we don't really like you.
I never understood. You know? Like, why? I mean, you know, Tucker Carlson got into this with some of his interviews, and like this whole question of Russia entering NATO in the late 90s, and we have these resets with, you know, the reset button with Hillary Clinton and all that, and all this attempts to do, and it never materializes. In fact, at each step of the way, we say one thing and do the opposite and encroach on NATO and do all this stuff, all the soft power stuff that we've been talking about. Why not? Mm-hmm. Like, why, other than mineral resources plays, because we just can't control them?
That's right. Yeah, we'd have to share too much decision-making authority with them. You know, Britain and France and Germany mostly go along. Sometimes the French buck, but they don't really get in our way. They'll just drop out from time to time and come back. But if we really brought Russia into NATO, they would be part of NATO. They're sitting on 8,000, 7,000 H-bombs, you know, 1,500 deployed, another 6,500 or so in reserve there. And they control all of North Asia, right? And the Arctic and a zillion dollars worth of natural resources for the long term. And so we would just have to share too much authority with them, decision-making authority with them. And that was, you know, when they created the NATO-Russia Council, I was a one world order kook. And I was like, oh no, see what they're doing? But I was wrong to see what they were doing. They were not bringing Russia into NATO. They were creating, as they called it, kind of tongue in cheek, an alliance with the alliance. You can be friends with us. We create this NATO-Russia Council. And then as Madeleine Albright explained, I wish I had read this at the time, or maybe I did and just didn't believe her. But Albright said to the Senate, listen, you guys got to believe me when I tell you, we are not giving any decision-making authority over to them. They are not part of the Atlantic Council, or the North Atlantic Council, it's called. The ruling clique of NATO, and they don't have a say in anything. They get, and there's a few different people I quote in the book paraphrasing it. They get to come into a room where we notify them of what our decisions that we've made have been. And that's it. And so, and they recognized it at the time. They, you know, I think some of them meant it. It ended up being just bait and switch stuff. But some of them meant it when they said, look, what we'll do is we'll really turn NATO into this political type organization and we'll replace it as a security organization. We don't really need an alliance anymore because there's no enemy. So we'll replace it with either the CSCE or later this organization they call the Partnership for Peace, which still exists. It's essentially just a halfway house for countries on their way to joining NATO when they pitched it as a replacement for NATO. And then the idea was that the Russians, the Ukrainians, Belarus, and everybody would all be members of it together. And then that way, and for that matter, the rest of Eastern Europe. So that way everybody's neutrality is baked in. This is the same thing with once that kind of idea fell apart, then William Perry, who was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Defense, said, well, then I'll tell you what we should do. We should bring, and this is what Yeltsin said, you should bring in Russia first. Then that way, when you bring in the other Eastern European nations, it doesn't matter.
Right.
We've already taken, in other words, instead of bringing in all these Eastern European nations until we get to Russia, because at that point it's clear what's going on here. We're bringing in all these countries into our alliance to protect them from Russia, which we've just turned back into a threat by bringing them back and bring them into our alliance in order to protect them from Russia. And it was, as they said, all along the worst kind of self-fulfilling prophecy in that way. And then they just went along anyway and they did it anyway.
Madness.
Well, we're going a little long, and I know you got stuff to do, Scott. Thank you so much for your time, man. That was awesome. I wish we could.
Absolutely. I really appreciate the opportunity, and everybody can go and check out the book. It's on Amazon.com right now. It's still number one in War and Peace after 3.5 months there, and it's doing real well. And look, the same as with all this stuff, I just am really intent on getting everybody caught up on everything I've learned thus far. So that's what it is. It's 8,000 note cards in a row for you there of all this stuff and citations for everything. And this whole history going back to the end of the last Cold War. And I really hope people like it. And thank you guys for having me on. I really appreciate
the audiobook. How do they get the audiobook?
Well, thank you for asking. It's right now, I'm putting it out as a subscription only podcast series at my Substack, which is ScottHortonShow.com. And it's also on my Patreon, which is patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And so far I have all of H.W. Bush and half of Bill Clinton out there for you, which is, I don't know, 6 or 8 hours worth to get you started. But the whole thing is going to be really long, so I have to do it.
I got a lot of long drives coming up this summer, so I will be subscribing to get my hands on that.
Well, listen, this is, I have a lot of traveling to do, obviously, to give speeches and promote the book. But otherwise, the audiobook is my highest priority right now. So I'm doing everything I can to get that stuff out for you. And again, yeah, that's all at ScottHortonShow.com. Fantastic.
Everybody go to ScottHortonShow.com. Get your hands on Provoked. It's a brilliant book. I'm working my way through it as we speak. Looking forward to the audiobook. And follow Scott on X as well. We'll put all the links in the show notes below. Thank you guys so much for checking this out today. Scott, thank you so much for joining us. And everybody, we will see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember...
I'm sorry, I got distracted on the stupidity of the way that he's going back and forth with him about it.